Okay, the Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order. Welcome. It is Tuesday, March 10th. We have a lot of really interesting things on the agenda today. We're going to go a little bit out of order. We're going to start at the bottom where it says public hearing and work session and think about it like a sheet of music, then go up to the top to the informational hearing, and then come back to the public hearings last to allow people to get here and to make sure that we can give as much time as possible for the discussions on Senate Bill 500 and Senate Bill 501. So I'm going to start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 222. Yes, Cheyenne, would you summarize?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 222 extends the sunset on Department of Human Services authority to proceed as a party to certain juvenile cases without the Attorney General from its current sunset date of 2015 to 2017. It declares an emergency is effective on passage. Just delivered prior to the hearing was the Dash 1 amendment, and it was uploaded on OLIS. And it basically repeals DHS's stopgap authority to appear without counsel in juvenile cases on a graduated basis, the idea being that they appear with counsel, beginning with six counties by the end of 2015, another six counties by June of 2016, 12 more counties by June of 2017, and then in all remaining counties by June 2018, and then extends the sunset to June of 2018.
And a group has been, we'd scheduled this for a public hearing early on. We did not hold the public hearing because it was clear that there was still some more work to be done. And the groups have been working really hard together, DOJ, DHS, and OJD. There was a note that came back just within the last hour from legislative counsel that suggested that the amendment may be unconstitutional, so we probably are going to have to do a little bit more work to find a constitutional solution to this difficult issue. So I'd like to start with Lois Day and whoever wishes to come up from the Department of Justice and OJD. So if we can have the three agencies together at once. Welcome. And Lois, would you kick us off, please?
Thank you, Chair Gelson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lois Day. I'm the Child Welfare Director at the Department of Human Services. I have a few comments, and then we have Judge Hill here and members from the Department of Justice as well. The department is in favor of this bill, as amended and hopefully resolved. This amendment outlines a schedule of implementing full legal representation of the department in juvenile proceedings by 2018. Just for some background for the members of the committee, any time child welfare places a child in care, a petition has to be filed in the juvenile court. The court remains involved as long as the child is in foster care and sometimes even beyond. The court holds the department accountable for our actions with families and the well-being of children while in our care. Child welfare work has become increasingly complex, and the oversight of the juvenile dependency courts is critical to keeping children safe and helping families become stronger and better able to care for their children. The court system works best when there is skilled representation of all parties to the proceeding. Currently, parents and children have access to court-appointed counsel in dependency proceedings, and passage of this bill with the amendment will provide representation, full representation by the Department of Justice for the Department of Human Services. Just a little historical context, ORS 9.320 requires state agencies to appear in court proceedings with legal counsel, and that legal counsel has been identified in another statute as the Department of Justice. Historically, child welfare workers have appeared in a variety of court proceedings without counsel. In pre-jurisdictional proceedings, there is district attorney representation in most counties on behalf of the state, and as long as the department's position is not in conflict with the district attorney's position, that's all the counsel that is there. If they're in conflict, we are able to have someone from the Department of Justice represent us. In post-jurisdictional proceedings, if they're uncontested, we have not had counsel. If the hearing becomes contested, it could be set over to allow the department to appear with counsel. However, this does cause a delay in the proceeding. There can in 2006, in recognition of the need for additional legal services for child welfare, there were additional assistant attorney generals added and an allocation of funds to better support district attorneys doing this work, but there continued to be hearings where caseworkers were the only party not represented by counsel. In 2013, some courts began requiring the department to appear in all proceedings with counsel. Because we were not budgeted for this increase in legal services, the legislature in the 2014 session passed House Bill 4156, which created this exception that we're discussing today, allowing child welfare to appear without counsel in uncontested hearings and in pre-jurisdictional hearings when a DA is present and our positions were congruent. This legislation allowed the Department of Human Services and the Department of Justice, in consultation with the Judicial Department, adequate time to explore the most cost-effective method of providing this increase in representation. The sunset, as you know, was set to expire, the exception was set to expire in July of 2015. For the past year, the Department of Human Services, the Department of Justice, and the Oregon Judicial Department have been in conversation about options available to us to achieve full representation in the most cost-effective manner for the state. We've explored regionalization, video appearances in uncontested matters, consolidated docket days, and the use of Special Assistant Attorneys General, or SAGs, in limited cases when the Department of Justice believed that's the most effective representation. The plan and the amendment would create a rolling implementation beginning in 2015 and concluding in 2018. If passed and if constitutional, the department and the Department of Justice, in consultation with Oregon Judicial Department, will identify the order of implementation on a county basis to achieve full representation by 2018. I'd like to thank Senator Gelster and Senator Cruz for your continued support of this effort we've been undertaking, and I'm available for any questions the committee may have after my partners present. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Norm Hill. I'm one of the circuit court judges in Polk County. I do the primary bulk of the juvenile work there, and this issue sort of came to light in Polk County. So if you'd indulge me, I'd like to sort of give you a sense of how we got here. Traditionally, and I think this is the case for most counties, and Polk County was no exception, at the pre-jurisdictional stage, the district attorney handled the representation for the Department of Human Services. And it works well. There's somebody that's local. You have a locally elected official that's accountable to the voters, that's sort of a gatekeeper, and they're there connected to the local, in close connection to the local DHS office. Given the budget difficulties that Polk County had over the last few years, the amount of funds that were provided by the Department of Justice to provide that representation was not enough, and in fact, they historically didn't take any of those funds because it wasn't enough. But they weren't able to do it. And so they came to the courts and they came to DHS and said, we can't provide representation anymore. And so the department came to the judges, and me in particular, and said, we're just going to not have representation at all. And in fact, what will happen is if we turns out when we're in the middle of the hearing we need something, we're going to ask for a continuance and we'll set it over. And that simply wasn't acceptable. And there are a couple of key reasons why representation is so important, particularly on the front end, but throughout the process. And that's because this dependency law, especially in the last 10 years, has become very complicated. It's become very the legal issues in it have become more intense. The Court of Appeals has been more active. And so it's critically important to have someone representing the state's interest and in that sense, the children's interest in this process so that you can head off issues later. The second problem is our time frames in juvenile dependency cases are compressed. We have to have a jurisdictional hearing and determine whether or not to take wardship over that child within 60 days from the date the initial petition is filed. So there simply isn't time to have a continuance and to sort of start over in order to meet those requirements. But the real problem that we saw is it puts the court in a horrible position, because if the caseworkers, and they do a great job, but they're caseworkers, they're not lawyers, and to ask them to appear and in some cases be both a witness and a legal advocate in the same proceeding, from my perspective, becomes very dangerous. Because as a judge, I'm always concerned that I'm not getting the whole picture. It's sort of looking at this family through a keyhole, and you get little pieces of it. But when one party is represented, as is most often the case in these hearings, and the state isn't, it's not clear that we're getting the whole picture from that caseworker, and there's no one there to help the caseworker with that. Puts the judge in the position of either not getting the information we need to make a good decision, or acting as effectively the de facto lawyer for one side, and that's inappropriate. So for those reasons, we indicated that, and the current state of the law was, the agency has to have an attorney representing the agency in court proceedings. The bill that was passed in the last session was a stopgap measure, and it appears that the primary issue in simply having full representation is the funding. And so this proposal to sort of roll it out seems to alleviate that. The other piece, and I understand OJD is amenable to this to the extent possible, is local courts, in the way that they organize juvenile hearings, can have some control over the timing of those that'll mitigate some of the costs for DOJ. For example, in Polk County, we hold the bulk of our routine juvenile matters 2 afternoons a week. So it allows somebody to concentrate. And frankly, it has been, our experience has been wonderful in the last year or so, because the attorney representing the agency can actually meet with the caseworkers before they're going to go to court in the afternoon. The hearings are, they're better represented. The caseworkers feel more comfortable. And the feedback I get from the people in the field is they appreciate being represented and not going in all alone. So those are the comments that I have. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. DOJ.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Udland. I am the Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division at the Department of Justice. With me is Joanne Southey. She's my Deputy Chief Counsel and is primarily in charge of the child welfare work that we do. We are here today to testify on behalf of the Dash 1 amendments. I will note at the outset we did just receive the note about the constitutionality. We believe that's an issue with the language and not the concept. Okay. So we think that can be worked out, although obviously we haven't had time to have those conversations. So. By way of background, each year, Department of Human Services Child Welfare Program provides services to approximately 8,000 children. The caseworkers ensure that children are brought into state care when necessary and returned to their families when possible. When this is not possible, child welfare caseworkers work hard to ensure that children are freed for adoption, placed in guardianships or other permanent plans as quickly as possible. Department of Justice represents DHS in many phases of this process, but it has long been the case that in many Oregon counties that child welfare caseworkers appear in court without legal representation. A number of problems have arisen with this practice over the years. Child welfare caseworkers are highly trained and strong advocates for their agency position, but they are not lawyers, and they're not trained in the technical areas of the law, how to present evidence, and how to ensure that judicial documents are crafted correctly. Everyone involved in the work agrees that juvenile dependency cases would be better prepared and better presented in court, and families and children would be better served over time if child welfare caseworkers had legal representation. Nonetheless, funding has been lacking over time. In 2014, in the 2014 legislative session, this legislature enacted House Bill 4156, which preserved the status quo by allowing caseworkers to continue to appear in court without legal representation. Senate Bill 222 would sunset the status quo as of June 30, 2015, after which time caseworkers would require legal representation to appear in court. DOJ cannot support the bill as written because it ends the status quo without addressing the problem. As written, the bill would require representation immediately without providing adequate support to the Department of Justice for a thoughtful transition and without adequate fiscal funding for the Department of Human Services. Instead, Department of Justice has worked collaboratively with DHS and the Oregon Judicial Department to propose the amendments, the Dash 1 amendments, that will allow for a staged implementation of caseworker representation to be spread over 3 years, with all caseworkers in all counties being represented in juvenile dependency hearings by June 30th of 2018. So specifically under the proposed amendments as currently written, the Department of Human Services and the Department of Justice, in conjunction with the Oregon Judicial Department, would agree on 6 counties in which the program would be up and running and full representation would occur by December 31 of 2015. 6 more counties would come online by June 30 of 2016, 12 additional counties by June 30 of 2017, and the remaining counties by the end of June 2018. So the purpose of the amendments, we want to ensure that rollout of full representation is done in a thoughtful manner. We want to mitigate the immediate financial impact to the state of Oregon by spreading the cost over the 3 years of the rollout. We want to allow Department of Justice time to thoughtfully and adequately implement full representation. We need time to hire staff. We need time to train staff. And we would like to evaluate the process as it continues along in case we need to make adjustments. Lastly, we believe the rollout will allow us to coordinate with the Oregon Judicial Department on ways to reduce the impact of full representation, as Judge Hill mentioned, docket days, telephonic appearances, and those types of measures. So in conclusion, although DHS caseworkers are charged with protecting some of Oregon's most vulnerable young citizens, they are often faced with making legal decisions and presenting information and legal argument in court without the benefit of counsel. Providing DHS caseworkers with full access to legal counsel will allow caseworkers to focus on providing services to families rather than doing legal work. Staging the provision of legal services over a 3-year period of time will allow DOJ to get up and running in a thoughtful and planned manner and will allow the state to spread the startup costs over a period of time. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I have a technical expert here.
Great. Senator Cruz.
First, I want to thank you for your work on this thing. It's been a pretty productive work group that we've had, I think. I'm really happy with the product, but Judge, the one thing that you didn't mention, because it has more complicated and there are a lot more appeals, and the fact is that because you're sitting in that courtroom, you can read between the lines. When it goes up to the appellate level, they can't read that unless it's part of the record, which is why the representation is so important. One of the reasons the representation is so important.
But I didn't hear a question.
No questions. Just comment. Madam Chair, I was part of this work group, and yeah. I'm fully supportive of the product.
Great.
So,
any questions for this panel? And so in your brief look at the amendments and the note from council, you feel like we can fix this with language?
I think we can.
And
yes.
Still get to the general idea of the... Okay. Wonderful. Well, we will all follow up on that soon. Thank you all so much for working on this. I know it's been a lot of work.
And, Madam Chair, I would also point out that I have it on very good authority that the governor is fully supportive of this. So,
thank you very much. Next, we have Joe Basler and Mark McKechnie.
Can the governor
know? Kate and I have been working on this for a long time. So.
Can you see?
Welcome.
Chair Gelsler, Chair Gelsler, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler. I represent Oregon AFSCME. We represent the attorneys at Assistant Attorney General's at the Attorney General's office. And the original bill, the reason I'm testifying today, we are definitely opposed to the original bill. We appreciate DOJ and DHS working on a compromise. It's still not the best thing in the whole world for us. I mean, I also want to take this opportunity to plug the good work our assistant AGs do. They are lawyers who are dedicated to public service. They are very talented. They often tell me that the amount they bill to the agencies is far less than they could bill in the private sector, and that we believe the state gets a very good deal with the advice that they give. And it helps stop problems down the line around appeals and reversals. And this bill, the situation that's going on, I'm glad that we're trying to fix it and make it better. I don't have a lot to add. I think the direction that this amendment was going is probably the right direction, and we hope that it can work out constitutionally.
Thank you. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you too, Chair Gelsler. My name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice, Chair Gelsler, and members of the committee. I am here to raise some issues regarding Senate Bill 222. I'd be hard pressed to say I have a position, partly because the when amendments just became available. What I would like to highlight in this discussion are a few things. Our organization was involved in negotiating the bill that was passed in 2014 that has a sunset that the underlying bill addresses. And our feeling at the time was that we needed to maintain the status quo, the kind of practice that had been occurring for decades in this state, until a better solution could be developed to provide legal representation to the Department of Human Services and their caseworkers. Concurrently, there was a work group that was created in the 2013 session under House Bill 3363. It was the work group on juvenile court dependency proceedings that met throughout much of the interim that broadly represented the various stakeholders and constituents of the juvenile court system focused on juvenile dependency. And that work group came up with a bill that was introduced this session, House Bill 2358, which came up with a different approach, a pilot project approach to address 4 to 6 counties and improve resources for the courts, for DHS, for the legal representation of DHS, and for attorneys for parents and children. So I think it's important to highlight the difference in approach between Senate Bill 222 and that approach, in that Senate Bill 222 addresses legal representation for DHS alone and does not address some of the other needs in the system as a whole, which would also help to improve outcomes for the children and families who come in contact with the system. I don't disagree, and our organization does not disagree at all about the value of providing consistent and quality legal counsel and representation to DHS. It's simply an issue of limited resources and how they get allocated when no system has enough. And we've, I think, all lived under the reality for so long that no system is ever going to have enough resources, that it's become very it's just become the status quo. And frankly, I think this is an opportunity to take a harder look at how resources get allocated. And I think the other question that I am somewhat disappointed doesn't seem to have been part of this discussion is whether the model for paying for that legal representation should be different for Department of Human Services child welfare workers than it is for AG representation for other state agencies. I think that most agencies use the AG's office in a much different way to review policies and perhaps to represent them in a lawsuit or something like that. DHS requires legal counsel and representation on a daily basis. In the private sector and even in the public defense system, there are different models for paying for that legal representation. And I think that perhaps an FTE model or even in-house counsel for DHS could be more cost-effective models for this level of legal representation. And I don't believe that this bill addresses those potential alternatives. Well, it is true that more often parents and children have legal counsel at hearings when the state is not represented. It's not true in all cases. In many counties, parents are appearing at the very first hearing without legal counsel because of inadequate resources to provide that to them locally. And that is a critical juncture when their child has just been taken away, when the state is presenting its allegations, and it would be most useful for the parent to have legal counsel to represent them and to potentially challenge those allegations or to argue that removing their child was not a reasonable act and that their child can be safe remaining in their care. So I think there is a bigger picture here that is not being addressed by Senate Bill 222, and we certainly advocate for a bigger look at the system as a whole, making sure that all parts have adequate resources and that we're moving the various constituents and components of the system forward in an equitable manner to the extent that resources allow. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for these two?
Maybe a comment.
Senator Cruz.
I appreciate your perspective. I support the House bill as well. They don't cancel each other out in any way, shape, or form. We have a legal obligation that this is dealing with. The pilot for the rest of it is going to be is important as well. We need to pass both bills. I mean, that in my mind, that's the reality. And maybe we would have been smart to combine them into one, but this is the way we did it. One's in the House and one's here. But I think they both will pass by the end of the day here, but focused on the legal obligation in this bill, I think was appropriate on the front end. So that was my comment.
Thank you. Anything else?
No, but thank you, Senator Gelser. I like your idea of counsel being within DHS. When I, as a public health nurse and worked with at-risk families, I had to go to court as a witness for children who were being removed from parental control. Some of the case managers were great and others were not great. And I think it's an expertise. And I'm not sure if this bill is addressing that issue.
No, it's
no.
not, and,
okay.
and I'm not sure how appropriate that would be, actually. So I like the separation myself. So, you know, we don't want to get too much and nothing against DHS, but, you know, that would almost be the fox guarding the hen house if the lawyers were internal. I mean, the lawyers do their job, DHS does their job, and let's make sure that those functions happen. The system's good. It's just a matter of the fact that we've never funded it appropriately to get everything we need in place. And this is a plan to, over time, get us there. So.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both very much. Thank you, everyone. And we will schedule this again in the future. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 222 and open a work session on Senate Bill 225. I've already talked to John. Do you want to remind us what this bill was?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 225 was previously heard on the 3rd. It has no revenue impact and a fiscal statement issued whereby if the bill were in effect, savings could be experienced by DHS. It permits the Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority to inform benefits recipients of changes to supplemental nutrition, the regular and the WIC, via news media, information at sites, recipients frequent, and general mailings to recipients' households. It declares emergency is effective on passage. All of the stakeholders who raised issues, Mr. Mullins, Ms. Whitney Wise, and DHS, worked together and approved the Dash 2 amendment, which permits mass notifications only for suspensions or closures, but not for reductions in assistance, and makes the bill in its entirety applicable to WIC as well.
Great. Senator Olson.
Well, I'm looking up the amendment, Chair.
Okay.
As my understanding was, the problem with the bill was the word "not," and that we've basically what we've just done is we've left "not" in there and we've taken up reduction. I just wondered what the at our last hearing the word "not" was to be the difficult word,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't do anything with the word "not" and we removed reduction, and I just was curious as to why.
Madam Chair, I could perhaps clarify, Senator Olson, members of the committee. It was Mr. Mullins' suggestion after the fact, after the original testimony by the parties here, when they were instructed to work together. He made that suggestion, and they all got on board and agreed that was the change
happy.
To make.
Everybody happy? Okay.
I'm told that everybody's happy.
And that's what we need
I'm
to
I'm not have. Happy.
Well, Senator Cruz is never happy. I'm told that everybody except for Senator Cruz is happy.
Oh, you're talking about this bill. Okay.
So are you ready for me?
Yes, please.
Chair Gelser, I move to adopt the -2 amendments dated 2/11/2015.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt to... Let me start over. Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the -2 amendments dated 2/11/2015. Is there any discussion? Now you look really happy.
Okay. It changes.
Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted. Senator Olson.
Chair Gelser, I move Senate Bill 225 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 225 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. Senator Dimbrough, would you carry this
sure.
one? Thank you. All right. With that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 225 and open up an information hearing on youth suicide. And we have Amy Baker. She's here for something else, and we're good. We've already talked.
Hi. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I am here to give you an update on House Bill 4124 and talk to you about where our status is with creating the Youth Suicide Intervention and Prevention Strategic Plan.
Amy, can you start with your name for the record?
Yes.
Thank you.
I either remember to recognize the committee or my name, but never My name is Amy Baker, and I'm the Child and Family Manager with Addictions and Mental Health with the Oregon Health Authority. Thank you. So we essentially, last time I did an update, we essentially hired the Youth Suicide Intervention Coordinator in December. She started December 14th. She really wanted to be here. She sends her regrets, but she is in Klamath Falls trying to enlist the support and leadership of the tribal community to help us develop the Youth Suicide Intervention Strategic Plan. Since she's been here, she's been meeting with local partners and stakeholders to try to get a feel for Oregon's system. She has 20 years of experience in Idaho doing youth suicide prevention. And since that time, we have developed a framework for how we're going to create our strategic plan. And that is we have selected 29 members for a steering committee. That is broadly representative of veterans, the tribal community, military members, school psychologists, bereavement survivors, young adult voice, family members, prevention coordinators, primary care, child welfare, Oregon Youth Authority, and the Oregon Department of Education have all committed to serve on the steering committee. And we also had Youth Move has agreed to host 4 focus groups to ensure that we get a lot of young adult participation around what they think is going to work in terms of youth suicide prevention. The framework that we're using for this strategic plan is based out of the National Strategy for Suicide Prevention. It was it's enormous if you ever want to take a look. It was developed by a task force at a national level. It's been endorsed by the Surgeon General. It basically has 4 strategic directions. It's got 13 goals and 60 objectives that we hope to take and capitalize on what Oregon's strengths are right now. We think we have a lot that's going to assist us in the development of this, particularly with Oregon's efforts in healthcare transformation. There's been a lot of work done around integration, which is one of the key methods of addressing suicide risk. We hope to adopt the aspiration of zero suicides for Oregon. And essentially, in my 20 years of experience in the mental health field, I found that when you give up on one person, becomes really easy to give up on the next person. And at some point, you lose your curiosity about what you can do to change the system to really improve it. And so I hope that our steering committee will basically adopt that framework. The four strategic directions are very logical. It's about creating healthy and empowered individuals, families, and communities, and that includes things like creating messaging that encourages people to seek help when they need it. There's so much stigma right now around, you're seen as weak if you reach out for help. Promoting programs that create connectedness. One of the key risk factors for suicide is isolation, and hence one of the greatest protective factors is connectedness. Responsible media coverage when suicides do occur, so to prevent the possibility of contagion. Training for identification and prevention screening, targeting outreach to specific high-risk populations, treatment and support services, which includes things like evidence-based practices so that our mental health folks are appropriately screening for suicide risk and providing practices that are going to work. And the last strategic direction is surveillance, research, and evaluation. Basically, we need to use data to help inform our efforts and improve our strategies. So the steering committee is scheduled for three meetings, the first which is to start March 30th. And out of that steering committee, there's going to be potentially 4 to 5 work groups that we suspect there'll be probably at least 50 participants who will help us pick the strategy for which Oregon is going to pursue. We think that we'll have a completed product sometime in August, and then be able to present that in December at the next legislative session. In the meantime, I would suspect one of the questions is, what are we doing as things continue to pop up? Because obviously kids can't wait for us to develop our perfect and beautiful suicide intervention and prevention plan. We are, in every situation, we are continuing to bring technical assistance to local communities. There's a lot of work that you can do around things like postvention, so that when a suicide does occur, having an appropriate response to that is really critical to help, one, address the grief and the loss that some of the students who are, or the youth who are close to the person who suicided, basically, so that you don't risk losing another kid. Having a systemic approach to those situations, essentially, to prevent suicide. This is a much bigger issue than just what resides within the mental health system. And it's part of why the strategic plan is so important, is that we really need to enlist the support of all of our systems so that we can all respond appropriately when the situation arises. We are continuing to send resources to communities in need. For instance, our subcontractor youth move has gone to several communities to try to provide outreach, to do some reach kids who are at risk through Facebook and other social media venues. And we have prevention coordinators in every community that we're working with when things start to arise. It's not the system that we want right now. It's we are addressing this in some ways on a very ad hoc basis. And the goal is to really have a response that is formalized, that people agree to, and that we approach in every situation.
Could you talk a little bit about, one of the reasons I've been so interested in this is I live in the midst of a youth suicide cluster that didn't last for weeks or months, but we're about a year and a half into it. And we just a couple of weeks ago had a suicide pact at one of our middle schools. What is the response from your office when something like that happens, not just in the school, but across communities, because we see kids move through their soccer teams and their Boys and Girls Clubs and their other organizations across school districts. They don't recognize political boundaries.
Darn those kids.
Yeah.
We are... Basically, we, as soon as we hear about something that's happening, we reach out to our local community partners. And in the case of Albany, we reached out to Linn County. Well, first Benton County, but then Linn County. To basically make sure that they are addressing the needs of the school. The school is really, in some ways, the best entity to respond because the kids are there. They're captive. It's the place where you can reach them all at the same time. I think one of the challenges we have is that the mental health system, we're often guests. We're guests on the school campuses. It's right now. It's based on the natural relationships that we've built over time. In that particular instance, Linn County reached out to the school district as soon as they heard to try to get supports in place into the school. I think the other thing that we do is. Try to pull together our state partners who also have influence within their local systems. Again, it's not completely ideal because we need to formalize the protocol and the response.
Okay, thank you.
The other thing I just wanted to say about that real quick is that one of the things that we are hearing is that through the new investments with the school access to mental health services, we're hearing increased stories about these schools that now have mental health clinicians placed within them, hearing increased stories about kids who are highly suicidal, who would not have sought services otherwise. And we're getting, in fact, and probably even a couple from your district. So we know that we're headed in the right direction, that the more that we can get mental health folks located in natural settings like schools and school-based health centers and primary care offices, the more likely we're going to be able to reach kids in need. So it's moving in the right direction, but it's not fast enough.
Thank you. Are there other questions for him? No? Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you get through your presentation? I don't want to cut you off.
I did.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate your coming today and look forward to more updates on this important work. All right, I'm going to close the informational meeting on youth suicide and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 500.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 500 appropriates general fund dollars to construct a Boys and Girls Club in Rockworth area of Gresham and declares an emergency as effective July 1st, 2015.
Thank you. And I'm not sure how to do this, but out of an abundance of caution, I think I need to declare a conflict of interest because I sit on the board of a Boys and Girls Club. Is that
Thank
all
you,
I have
Madam
to
Chair.
Do?
I believe that's the rule on the House side.
There's well, we
not yet in
here?
Committee a corresponding rule,
okay,
but it certainly doesn't hurt an abundance of caution, as you said.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Monas Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale-Wood Village, Fairview, and parts of East Portland, and I'm delighted to bring to you Senate Bill 500. Basically, it appropriates money for construction of a Boys and Girls Club in Rockwood, which is in my district. The Rockwood community faces really critical challenges that place youth at a tremendous risk. We have the highest incidence of crime in our region's history, including gang violence and drug and sex trafficking, and we're trying to bring services with proven track records of success to Rockwood. East Multnomah County has very few resources. We have a very low tax base, and we're starting to get more services out there. But with the largest concentration of youth under the age of 18 within the metro region, Rockwood has led the state for the lowest academic performance and graduation rates. Over the past 10 years, gentrification has aggressively pushed poverty into East Multnomah County. 25% of the families in Rockwood are living at or below the poverty level, compared to 10% overall for Oregon. And the median household earnings are 23% lower than the average Portland metro. Rockwood families are twice as likely to receive state food assistance compared to state statistics, and unemployment rates for individuals living in Rockwood near 13% compared to Oregon's 8% overall. 9 out of 10 children living in Rockwood seek free or reduced lunch assistance. The Reynolds School District serving Rockwood youth post almost a 58% of students on track to graduate on time, compared with the national rate of 80%. 50% of the district's economically disadvantaged students are not on track to graduate on time, and only 50% of male students in the Reynolds District graduated on time in 2013. So as you can see, services are woefully lacking in Rockwood as well as in East Multnomah County. And of the 500 organizations serving children and families in the Portland metro area, only 15 are located within the Rockwood community that has the highest incidence of crime in the state of Oregon, the worst in the region's history. Since 2006, gang-related incidents across Multnomah County have increased 281%. Fundraising has already started for the Rockwood Center. I'm not going to get into the specifics of that because we have a lot of experts here to talk about it. But the primary goal is to raise $9.5 million to build and maintain the facility. And we are requesting in Senate Bill 500, although it's not stated, $1 million to help in this endeavor. The entire campaign goal is $13.2 million. Colleagues, we need to help the neediest. And Oregon needs to be a partner in this endeavor. The Boys and Girls Clubs have a track record of making a positive difference in kids' lives, and this facility will be a catalyst for positive change in my community. And I urge your support of Senate Bill 500. Thank you.
Representative Peluso, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Gelsler and members of the Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso, and I am the proud representative from House District 50, site of the future home of the Boys and Girls Club Rockwood. I'm here to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 500 to secure funding for a Boys and Girls Club facility in the Rockwood neighborhood. The mission of the Boys and Girls Club of Portland metropolitan area is to enable all young people, especially those who need it most, to reach their full potential as productive, caring, responsible citizens. And with your help and consideration, we can bring that mission to the families of Rockwood. The Boys and Girls Club Rockwood would serve East Multnomah youth and families from an area of Oregon known to be historically underserved and lacking in vital community services. I've worked in law enforcement for 30 years with the Gresham Police Department and was honored to serve as the chief for my last 6 years. I balanced my police career by working with nonprofits that support the needs of families living in or on the brink of poverty. I serve currently as the board chair of Human Solutions, a nonprofit that serves outer East Portland and East Multnomah County. I chair Multnomah County's Commission on Children's Families and Communities and regularly volunteer with SNOCAP Community Charities, the food bank for East Multnomah County. From my experience, I can tell you that the children in East Multnomah County are more likely to live in poverty, to be food insecure, and impacted by gang violence. The Boys and Girls Club Rockwood will benefit these youth and support families. It is so much more than an after-school program. Through the club, youth can and will receive academic support, career preparation, nutritional information and access to health care, a positive space to develop healthy relationships, mentoring programs, prevention and intervention services for youth impacted by drugs and alcohol or struggling with mental health issues. In the law enforcement and education communities, we know that the most effective programs in promoting positive life outcomes for youth are administered in their community. Without the Boys and Girls Club Rockwood, the children and teens that have the greatest needs for those services will be the hardest to reach. Additionally, programs like this support families by allowing parents to work or search for employment outside of normal school hours. Where there is a Boys and Girls Club in a community, the whole community is better for it. The Boys and Girls Club Portland and metropolitan area does great work and possibly impacts the lives of the children and teens in their programs. By supporting this new facility, we are transforming a neighborhood and serving the heart of the Rockwood community. I made Gresham my home 36 years ago. I chose to raise and educate my daughter in Gresham. I live, play, and work in Gresham. It is my home, it is my community, and I am proud to be a part of Gresham. I have lived in Gresham long enough to remember a strong Rockwood with a thriving business community, the best ever spring break carnival, neighbors helping neighbors, and fine restaurants. 5 years ago, the Rockwood Building, a multi-service center with affordable housing attached, was opened. 2 years later, the Multnomah County East County Courthouse was built, and 2 years after that, the Gresham Police Department Rockwood Precinct was built, all approximately with a one-mile radius of the new Boys and Girls Club Rockwood site. This construction will bring was the beginning of big change for Rockwood. I know, the addition of the Boys and Girls Club Rockwood will be the catalyst for needed change and tip the scale for the rebirth of the Rockwood neighborhood. It will be the anchor for change and the prosperity of Rockwood. Couple that with the growth of support, knowledge, self-esteem, and positive role modeling, and we will have children and teens that will be far less likely to be suspects or victims of crime. The Boys and Good Girls Clubs are crime prevention at its finest. In closing, we are lucky to have the CEO as well as the Chief Communication and Development Director of the Portland Area Clubs here, along with board and community members. They will address the specific needs of the plans for the facility, their funding needs, and collectively answer any questions you have. Thank you, Chair Gelser, and members of the committee. I thank you in advance for your consideration of support of our youth and my community. I appreciate your time and urge you to support Senate Bill 500. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any questions for our colleagues here? None. Thank you both very much. So next we have up Eric, is that Karsten?
Karsten.
Tracy Rose and Aaron Hubert, please. Welcome.
Thank you.
And the way this works is before you begin your testimony, if you just start with your name for the record, that will help us out a lot.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Eric Varston. I serve as the city manager of Gresham. It's an honor to provide testimony in favor of Senate Bill 500. For more than a century, the Boys and Girls Club have been a staple in communities across America, offering their proven brand of youth development guidance for our nation's most at-risk youth. These clubs can be found throughout our state, from Portland to Ontario down to Coos Bay, but not in Gresham. Over the past couple of years, Gresham has developed a strong partnership with the Boys and Girls Club of Portland metropolitan area. The clubs are eager to bring their services to Gresham's youth, and our residents are thrilled about the prospect of having a Boys and Girls Club in Gresham. In the interim, the Boys and Girls Club have begun serving some of Gresham's youth through scaled-back operations within three public schools, as well as in three of our city's parks through our new Summer Kids in the Park program. But as wonderful as these programs are, they are no substitute for the community's real need, a full-size, full-service facility dedicated to youth development located in the heart of Rockwood, our West Gresham neighborhood, with the greatest number of youth in need. The timing for this new Boys and Girls Club couldn't be better. From 2000 to 2012, the number of Gresham residents living in poverty has grown by 148.5%, while the overall population grew by just 17.6%. All the data shows that Gresham is rapidly becoming more diverse and economically challenged. Meanwhile, our own budget constraints have prevented the city from operating a youth recreation department for more than a decade. With a growing need and lack of other resources, there's arguably no community in the state in greater need of a Boys and Girls Club right now. The proposed facility and this important bill represent smart investments in health, education, and public safety. When this new Boys and Girls Club opens its doors, it will create opportunity for hundreds of at-youth risk every day. According to their most recent Boys and Girls Club National Outcomes Report, these young people will immediately become more likely to graduate from high school, more likely to attend college, less likely to engage in physical fights, and a host of other positive outcomes. This is exactly what Gresham needs in order to stimulate and sustain long-term progress in our community. Thank you for your consideration of this very important matter.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, thank you very much for having us here today. My name is Tracy Rose, and I am the Chief Advancement Officer for the Boys and Girls Clubs of Portland Metro. I'm going to echo a few of the comments that you've already heard today to set the stage for why we ended up in Rockwood. You've heard about the mounting effects of the gentrification of North and Northeast Portland and the push of poverty into East County. The community hardest hit by this rapid population growth is Rockwood. The largest concentration of youth, as you've heard, are under the age of 18. The Rockwood community today faces critical challenges that place young people at tremendous risk. These challenges include a burgeoning school district that is considered one of the largest in the state, serving youth within the boundaries of three city limits. Rockwood students are posting some of Oregon's lowest academic scores, and graduation rates rank 7% below state average at a time when Oregon ranks at one of the worst in the country. Rockwood arguably has the highest incidences of crime in our region's history, with the number of documented gang members living within this community tripling over the last 10 years. 40% of Multnomah County residents listed on probation or parole, and 50% of the child welfare cases are residing in Rockwood. This neighborhood also sports some of the region's highest incidences of child sex trafficking and drug-related crimes. As a result of the unexpected closure in early 2013 of the Police Activities League, the PAL Center, the only youth after-school and summer facility of its kind in East County, resulted in the loss of youth programming for the Rockwood neighborhood. Staying true to our mission of serving youth who need us most, Boys and Girls Clubs of Portland Metro stepped in to ensure a continuum of programming for the more than 300 youth served at the PAL Center. Our organization immediately raised nearly $400,000 to secure 2 years of funding to transition those youth into three school-based sites in partnership with the Reynolds School District. We are now poised to build a new Boys and Girls Club on the site of the former Drake 70s Nursery at the corner of Southeast 165th and Stark. The site, chosen by the mayor of Gresham for its visibility and accessibility in this community, provides the opportunity to repurpose an existing retail space into the new club design, which will save the organization approximately $500,000. In construction costs. The new facility will be approximately 30,000 square feet, and with the additional land on this site, active plans are underway to partner with non-redundant youth service organizations to create a campus of wraparound services dedicated to kids and families in the Rockwood community. So where there was once one youth service facility, there now in the next 2 years could possibly be four or more. Thank you.
And those four organizations would be serving youth from 0 to 18, I would add. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Erin Hubert, and I'm the CEO of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Portland. My thanks to Senator Mona Sanderson and Representative Beluso for their enthusiastic support of this bill. We know this is a really special opportunity, and thank you, Eric, for being here today. Well, you've heard some of the reasons why we've been so compelled to get involved with this project. With the largest school district in Oregon, there's arguably no other neighborhood in our great state that's in greater need than Rockwood. It has so many far-reaching implications on our state's key performance indicators relative to academic success and public safety success. It's bringing those down for the state. Boys and Girls Clubs of Portland serve youth from the ages of 6 to 18 in the neighborhoods that need us most. We provide enrichment wraparound services designed for impact and outcomes around three areas: academic excellence, good character and leadership traits, and healthy lifestyles. There is currently nothing like this in the entire Gresham community, and particularly Rockwood, serving youth in this comprehensive fashion. At the moment, we operate in four Portland metro counties with six standalone club sites. We are also embedded in seven schools in partnership with three school districts, including Park Rose, Reynolds, and Clackamas, serving over 7,000 youth a year. Membership fees are $5 per year for the youth we serve in these distressed communities. If they can't pay it, we scholarship it. And generally, if they're not paying it, it's because you have completely disengaged parental situation, which surprisingly is about 75% of our youth base, unfortunately. Only about 15% of our funding comes from any sort of government funding, including county, city, state, or federal funds. Thus, we fundraise for the preponderance of our annual operating needs, which is currently around $5.5 million. As Senator Manas Anderson said, this overall project is a $13.2 million project. It will allow us to build a 30,000 square foot facility. It will have a full-size gym, an industrial kitchen that will feed snacks and fully chef-prepared dinners every evening for the kids. Many times it's one of the few meals they get in the day. It will have enrichment teaching rooms, an art room, music room, a teen center, and playrooms. It will also have this extra field that maybe a soccer field. We're still figuring out the best use that will also serve the community as well as our kids. This campaign will also raise 3 years' worth of operating funds for the new facility, which is a Boys and Girls Clubs of America best practice requirement. It will create a maintenance reserve to keep the building functional and safe well into the future. And it will infuse money into our overall organization so that taking on this new project doesn't cannibalize our current and future financial stability, which was a little shaky coming out of the recession. While the many issues this long-suffering community has faced were long treated as solely aggression problem, that's changed. Jurisdictional lines between Portland and Gresham are melting away quickly. Civic leaders, business leaders, and community leaders are recognizing that given the size and scope of this community and the woeful statistics that are worsening each year, it's time we all take notice and come up with solutions to stem the tide of spiraling statistics. It's no longer just Gresham's problem. It's now a Portland Metro and statewide concern that we all must join together to address. That's why we're here before you today, and I thank you.
Thank you all very much. Are there questions for this panel? Senator Dembrough.
I do, and I'd like to follow up on that last comment. I represent the district that's right next to Senator Mona Sanderson's, and you know, I suspect that many of the kids who will be going to this center will be from my district, and so I fully understand the, you know, the challenges that that are faced there. Most people in around the state don't realize that Multnomah County is home to some of the greatest poverty in the state. They think of Multnomah County as a place of great wealth, but the reality is, of course, very different. The pushback that we can expect to get from some of our colleagues is why this one-off, you know, contribution to this center, and I think you were getting at something very important at the end. I wonder if you could expand on that a little bit. You know, why should we why should we single out this area, you know, as opposed to something that would benefit the entire state?
From my point of view, I think it, excuse me, Chair Gelser and Senator Dembrough, from my point of view, I think it's reached a tipping point where it's bringing the state down. Again, for a long time, this community suffered with these issues, and it was gentrification from Portland, and I think it just didn't get paid attention to, and it has reached such a crescendo that I'm seeing all the leaders come together, regardless of jurisdiction, Portland to Rockwood. But I'm even seeing now is it almost feels like the state needs to come together because Reynolds is so big, that school district, and this community, it's bringing our statistics down in the state. We're the worst graduation rate in the entire country with some of the worst absenteeism rates. And this is the largest school district. You can start to see where all of a sudden it has a unique situation that probably needs a one-off, where before maybe not. Did I articulate that a little bit better, what you're looking for?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Senator Monson.
We had talked about this before through emails, trying to maybe see if there was certain funding available within our budget here in Ways and Means. And could you talk a little bit about the conversation that you had with the former chief of police of Portland and designating possibly funds coming from a certain piece of whatever.
Chair Gelser and Senator Mona Sanderson. In fact, former Chief Reese, I still call him Chief, is with us today. He's the board chair for my board. And he was speaking to me about some funds he was aware of tied to prisons that wasn't going to be spent that looks like it's going to reside in the Ways and Means Committee. And so there is a pool of money there that there is some discretion to it, if I understand how these things work, that might relate to this bill.
And colleagues, I've relayed that to Ken Rocco in Legislative Fiscal, and he was very interested in that fund too, because they're always looking for ways to maybe support asks like this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I do have another question. Yeah. So I'm pretty familiar with the Boys and Girls Club that's adjacent to the Rosa Parks School in North Portland, mm-hmm. which is a great partnership. And I assume, even though there won't be a co-location kind of thing here, there'll be relationships between the various school districts. I mean, I don't know if it's just Reynolds or, you know, does Portland have an influence, Gresham, I don't know. But what sort of partnerships are you looking at?
Chair Gelser and Senator Dembro, several. We're currently in Park Rose and three Reynolds School Districts serving, and once this club gets built, our goal will to be then spread and infill with other schools so that we can encroach further east as funds are raised. The partnerships that we're really excited about, Friends of the Children, which is a high level mentorship organization. We originally were going to be partnered with them at the PAL site, which was a tight squeeze, but the mayor really implored upon us to move to this other facility, which is going to work out for the best. So they'll be six blocks away, and we'll be partnered sharing services. Next door to us is going to be Open Meadow. They're changing their name to Open, an alternative school. So they'll actually be housed right next door to us. They will get to save $1 million on their project because they will use our kitchen and our gym. Their students will be members, and they're going to serve students 7th to 8th grade, which is a new model, because the next wave you're going to start reading about over time is 8th grade dropout rates are starting to become a real factor. And then the third partner that we're hoping, when we first took this property over, the mayor had a parcel in mind for us, and he wanted to save the rest of it for future business use. Part of the reason they took this property was, if not, developers would come in and build more apartments. And apartments have become a real problem in Rockwood, and it's about 60% apartments now, and that's where a lot of the crime, it's low poverty, so that's where the crime goes. So they took it to prevent more apartments being built and for future business, and we went to them and asked, would you let this be a campus of services? And they've been terrific, and the city is just amazing to work with, and they said yes. So Open is secured, they're going to be there, and we're working with early childhood provider the Family Relief Nursery and Mount Hood Head Start to provide services from 0 to 5 on the fourth corner. There's sort of four corners to this parcel. And there's a current home on the one parcel that Drake 70s is operating their warehouse business from, and that's where the preschool would go, and it needs very little work to be modified into a preschool. So you would have 0 to 18. That's the continuum of services that we'll be serving through these partnerships that we're just really, really geeked about.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
So next we have Mike Reese and Brian Gastelum. Welcome.
I'll break the ice for Brian and go first. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing us to come and speak to you today. My name is Michael Reese, and I'm here in my capacity as the chair of the board for the Boys and Girls Clubs of Portland. I'm also the recently retired chief of police for the Portland Police Bureau. And prior to my 25 years in law enforcement, I worked for the Boys and Girls Clubs of Portland as a club director at our Waddles Club in Southeast Portland. I know the organization well and have appreciated their good work in our community for many, many years. Our clubs are a safe and welcoming place for kids. The staff are caring professionals dedicated to enriching the lives of every child who walks in the door. The clubs serve a richly diverse population, mainly in areas impacted by economic need. I'm really excited about the opportunity for us to expand into Rockwood to serve the kids and the families there with a new facility. I've worked in that community as a deputy sheriff and as a police officer. In fact, then Sergeant Peluso back many, many years ago was my sergeant. And we worked in the Rockwood area in a collaborative relationship between the Gresham Police and Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. I know the challenges of the kids face that the kids face in that area, with little in the way of positive places for them to grow and develop into capable adults. Our new club will fill that need, providing a safe place for them where they can participate in programs designed around academic enrichment, the arts, and athletic programs. We are asking for your financial support of this new facility in Rockwood. We need your help to make this club a reality for the kids and their families. Thank you.
Welcome, Brian.
Well, my name is Brian Gastelum Plata, and I've been a club member at Waddles Boys and Girls Club for 12 years. The Waters Boys and Girls Club has made me who I am today. When I entered high school, I didn't think I'd go to college. Now I'm a senior and I've been accepted to 2 4-year universities. Growing up at Waters Boys and Girls Club has made me a big influence on my life. If I hadn't joined the club, I don't think I'd be involved in sports. Being able to join sports leagues at the club like soccer, basketball, and flag football made me realize how much I love sports. Sports play a large role in my life today. The club has taught me how to reach out and help people in my life and in my community. It has also helped me develop a good work ethic in school and as well in sports. Being one of the oldest teens at Waddles has helped me be a leader and has shown me how to be a good role model to younger kids. The club has given me multiple opportunities to develop my leadership skills. I have coached basketball, soccer, flag football, and kickball. I've learned being a coach is about being a role model. Being a leader means I have to act right, listen, and be responsible. I have learned to combine my leadership skills with sports, and I am a successful scholar-athlete at Cleveland High School. The club has always encouraged sportsmanship and hard work, and those are values I believe in. I am a 5-time varsity letterman, and I am a captain of the wrestling team, and as well as having played soccer and lacrosse. These experiences helped me lead my school wrestling team as both captain and coach. Finally helped me become a member of the Gresham Fire and Rescue Cadet Program, which has been a great experience for me. I could have not done this without the support and love I found at the Waters Boys and Girls Club. The club has done so much for my family and me. When we have struggled financially, they have given us boxes full of food every year, helped to celebrate Christmas by giving us presents to put under our tree, and of course, giving us a place to call home. I'm passionate about the Boys and Girls Club, and I want to give back for everything they have done for me. Giving back is one of the best feelings I've experienced. Seeing people smile makes me feel good inside. I've never done community service because I have to. I do community service because I want to, and I have fun doing it. The club has given me opportunities to volunteer by joining Torch Club when I was younger, and now being an active member in Keystone Club. All these experiences have helped me decide what I want to do in the future, and that's become a firefighter. Firefighting will allow me to stay involved in my community, from helping someone from a life-threatening situation to just being a hero and making people feel safe. Growing up without a father,
You're doing great.
Growing up without a father created a lot of challenges for me. I've had to teach myself how to be a man. I faced challenges throughout every aspect of my life. I remember watching my friends getting picked up by their parents after school. While my brother and I were left to take the city bus at the age of 6. And I would always have to get home before my mom. Because of this, I would have to make dinner for myself. My family and I have always struggled with money. Having to move to different places every year because my mom couldn't pay rent, it made it hard for me to get comfortable in my community. When I was 6 years old, I went to divorce therapy with my siblings. It was there when I was introduced to the Waters Boys and Girls Club. My mom signed me up, and that's when it all changed for me. The club gave me somewhere I could go after school. They gave me a roof over my head, food to eat, and a place to play. There was one community that would always be in my heart, and that's the Lens community. No matter how much I move around Portland, I know that the Waters Boys and Girls Club will be a place I can call home. The Boys and Girls Club has also introduced me to my role model, who I consider to be my second mom. That person is Ashley Campbell. She has been there for me since I was 6 years old. She is the person I go to for advice and the person I go to when I'm feeling down. She has inspired me in many ways and has always been there for my family and me. From mentors to sports, community service, and anything in between, the Boys and Girls Club have helped me grow and really find myself. I would like to thank the Waters Boys and Girls Club for everything they have done for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Have you testified to a committee before?
No.
You're really good. You should do it more often, like a pro. Are there questions for this panel?
No, but you certainly brought tears to my eyes. Your story is heart-wrenching, and yet you are who you are today because of the Boys and Girls Club. I'm really excited for you.
If I could just add, Madam Chair, I'm sure that you will become a heroic firefighter, but you won't do a greater act of heroism than you've just given for us in telling us from your heart your story and helping to build, you know, a future community for people like you. So thank you for coming forward.
Well, and good luck in college next year to four-year institutions. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Will you be the first in your family to go to college?
My sister, too. She was a Boys and Girls Club member as well, and she works for the club now. She goes to Reed College.
Mm-hmm. So. Oh, my goodness.
Well, thank you so much for making time to come down here today. You did a really great job for the club today.
Thank you.
Thank you. You did too, Mr. Reese.
I'm glad I went first.
Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 500? Because you've got a really tough act to follow. Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 500 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 501.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 501 appropriates general fund dollars to the Oregon Youth Authority for East Metro Gang Enforcement Team, declares emergency effective July 1st, 2015.
And we've got Senator Mona Sanderson and Representative Peluso back again.
Oh, no, I'm up last. One of these.
Oh, you're up last. Yeah. All right.
I'll just start.
We'll have her start, and then we will bring you last.
I'll just be very brief, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Mona Sanderson, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 501. Basically, we have a severe gang problem in our district, and I think that the people that will follow me can give you much better information than I. With that, I will turn it over to those who know this issue much better than I.
Thank you. Eric, I'm just messing up your name again. Sergeant David Schmidt and Joe McFerrin, please. I apologize.
Taser.
It's never easy getting in this chair.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you, and no apology necessary. If I get through this without calling you mayor, I'll be happy. So thank you very much. Madam Chair, again, my name is Eric Kvarsten. I've served as a city manager of Gresham the past 10 years, and as city manager, I'll be sure to hire that young man as a firefighter. There. Part of my time in Gresham, I also served as the city administrator in Troutdale for 8.5, so out in that part of the county for quite some time now. I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 501, the MGET funding, and this funding is critically important to Gresham's ability to control gang activity and maintain public safety and livability. Now, normally we'd have our police chief and our gang prevention advisor here to testify as well, but they are both currently in Washington, D.C., along with our partners in Multnomah County, getting technical assistance from the federal government, learning how to do a better job with lower-level youth offenses. Their absence is a perfect example of the growth we have had in just a couple of years in prevention, outreach, and intervention, which dramatically complement our traditional and vital gang enforcement efforts. Earlier in my testimony, I went over some really just staggering numbers about the poverty in Gresham. I won't belabor that to point, but suffice to say that we've experienced, again, dramatic change, transforming from a rural and suburban environment to a very urban community, complete with a new host of law enforcement challenges, including significant challenges with gang activity. State support through the funding for East Metro Gang Enforcement Team has been a critical component to our ability to react to those urban law enforcement challenges since 2005. This East Metro Gang Enforcement Team is collaborative and multi-jurisdictional. It's under the direction of leadership of Sergeant Dave Schmidt, here with us today. And the team includes two other Gresham police officers, as well as officers from City of Fairview, City of Troutdale, and two Multnomah County deputies. The team also works in close partnership with Portland's Gang Enforcement Team, often dealing with the same gang-affected or gang-affiliated individuals. In addition to solid enforcement work, we have taken substantial measures to improve our outreach, prevention, intervention, and youth engagement services. We've added two civilian outreach workers who provide positive intervention for at-risk youth. This service is provided through a partnership with the Portland Opportunities Industrialization Center, which President and CEO Joe McFerrin will describe in greater detail. In addition, we have successfully leveraged partnerships to add late-night basketball for at-risk youth, student mindfulness training to teach stress coping skills, and programs to assist out-of-school and unemployed gang-impacted youth with GED preparation, resume workshops, and job placement. Thank you again for the opportunity to provide testimony today for this important service. The East Metro Gang Enforcement Team is one of our most critical, dedicated units and serves in one of the most important areas of law enforcement in our community. Truly, the legislature's vision in providing funding has enabled us to create a comprehensive local, state, federal, and nonprofit partnership which addresses gang issues with every critical element: prevention, youth engagement, outreach, enforcement, and effective prosecutions, and youth justice. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I am Sergeant Dave Schmidt, and I am supervisor of the East Metro Gang Enforcement Team. And I'd like to say that I would going to do my best to pull that young man over to police instead of being fired. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today and express the importance of funding in our coordinated approach to gang enforcement and suppression. Our seven-member multi-agency team has produced significant progress in this area. In 2014 alone, the team made 233 felony arrests, seized 82 illegal weapons, and had over 1,300 contacts with suspected gang members. Additionally, we documented 96 new known gang members, bringing the total population in the area to around 500 specifically documented gang members. The population of documented gang members is only a fraction of the actual population of gang members, which is likely between 1,500 to 2,500. When we consider these numbers, they are not unique to the areas of Gresham, Troutdale, Fairview, and Wood Village, served by the East Metro Gang Enforcement Team. Gang members know no jurisdictional boundaries. We routinely deal with people from all across the state in our enforcement activities. And when we do enforcement right in our area, we are also preventing gang activity that would have ultimately been exported to other communities in the state as well. Not only is the East Metro Gang Enforcement Team critical when it comes to holding the line against gang activity, but it provides an important synergy when it comes to some of our more conventional police services. On any given night, a patrol officer may receive a call for service in neighborhood and multifamily apartment complex where gang members are known to frequent or reside. In those cases, our gang enforcement team is able to assist in the call, help identify any people with known gang affiliations, and potentially intervene in gang activity that may have otherwise gone unnoticed. As City Manager Kvarsten noted, the combination of the enforcement and prevention efforts has provided strong results. In 2013, six of our seven homicides in Gresham were gang-related. In 2014, just one homicide was gang-related. Leading a team with members from our four different law enforcement agencies has been a particular honor, and the officers who serve on this team all come with a depth of knowledge from their communities, which enhances our knowledge and effectiveness. When that is combined with our partnerships with nonprofit associations and the county, state, and federal governments, we are bringing a truly unique approach to the issue and are poised for success. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today and for your continued support of this critical service area. When gangs are able to operate without a specific and experienced law enforcement presence, they can take over a community very rapidly and use that community as a nucleus for the networks across the state and nation.
Thank you.
Senator Gelser, and members of the committee, I am Joe McFerrin, the second president and CEO of Portland OIC and the Rose Mary Anderson High School. But before I start, I think I could get that young man. I'd like to get that young man an alternative education. I think he can make a pretty huge impact. I'm honored to provide testimony on behalf of the East Metro Gang Enforcement Team. In 1983, Portland OIC established an alternative high school at the request of Portland Public Schools to accommodate disadvantaged youth who were failing in the public school system. More than 30 years later, we continue the work of reconnecting at-risk youth with their education through our three Rosemary Anderson High School campuses and with career training and collaboration with our community partners. We mentor and support our graduates as they pursue post-secondary education and careers up to the age of 25. For most youth, the small school size and one-on-one attention from staff is critical for their ability to engage. We have an 86% graduation rate for our high school students who enroll and attend our schools. In addition to our education, employment, and family services, POIC offers street-level gang outreach services throughout Multnomah County. In partnership with the Gresham Police Department, we employ two full-time outreach workers in East Multnomah County. These experienced individuals are challenged with engaging at-risk and gang-involved youth to build trusting relationships and direct them towards positive activities. Outreach workers assist youth in non-traditional settings, such as parks, street corners, and at MAC stops, during hours when violence is most likely to occur, particularly evenings and weekends, as data indicates. Street-level gang outreach workers must maintain a delicate balance while they communicate regularly with the East Metro Gang Enforcement Team. To close a connection with law enforcement, too close a connection with law enforcement can diminish their ability to gain and maintain trust with youth and young adults. Our partnership with MGET is vital to POIC's holistic approach to serving at-risk youth and families. Outreach workers are often called to the scene of gang and youth-related crimes to help calm down witnesses, families, and community members. Often their actions after such a crime will help deter future violence. East Metro Gang Enforcement Team officers may also refer gang-impacted youth to the services of gang outreach, who will then help those youth connect to positive activities. Over the past year, POIC has also had an opportunity to partner with the City of Gresham on a number of new gang prevention projects funded by the Oregon's Youth Development Council. Our student mindfulness program, for example, is helping our students learn how to cope with stress and avoid violence through yoga and meditation. We have also started a new late-night basketball program to engage at-risk youth in positive activity on Friday nights when gang crime is prevalent. These programs are having an immediate impact on our community's at-risk youth, and we look forward to continuing our partnership with the City of Gresham and the East Metro Gang Enforcement Team in providing a comprehensive approach to gang activity spanning from prevention through suppression. The police know they cannot solve this problem with suppression alone. Likewise, we know that we can't solve the problem only through prevention and intervention services. But with the right combination of these strategies and by working together, we have an opportunity to ensure that gang violence does not come to define East Multnomah County and Gresham. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? This is Senator
Anderson. Thank you. This is basically for Eric Kvarsten. We have one of the lowest tax bases in Oregon, correct?
Madam Chair, Senator, correct.
And what percentage of our budget it goes to police and fire? I'd heard it's over 90% or right around there.
Madam Chair, Senator, that's correct, over 95%.
95%?
Madam Chair, yep. Senator, yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
And so that tells you why there's such a need. We couldn't even pass our police levy last time. We live in a very poor area, and to try to get funding to pay for our services is extremely difficult. And so we're coming here. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, ma'am.
Our next panel is Nathan Vasquez, Muriel Moda, and Tracy Freeman, please. Welcome.
I'd be happy to start.
Great.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nathan Vasquez, and I'm a deputy.
Can you tilt the microphone your direction? Thank
Let's
you.
Try that.
Perfect.
Okay. I'll start again. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nathan Vasquez, and I'm a deputy district attorney with Multnomah County. I have worked in that capacity for the past 15 years. During that time, I've really spent a majority of my career working on East County crimes and East County cases. I worked specifically out of the Gresham Courthouse and before it became the new and beautiful facility it is today. And I also worked directly with Chief Peluso. During my time in East County, I've seen a significant rise in gang violent crime. Currently, what we've done within the District Attorney's Office to help in the many efforts that are going on out in the region is to form a community work group called the Renew Project. It's designed specifically to work with community partners, law enforcement, with various government agencies to bring together services and help fill any gaps that are there and to work a network of providers to help the area. Specifically in my career, I've dealt with everything from beginning at the bottom, traffic violations as a new deputy DA, that many of which, oddly enough, involve gangs, but also working up, I've done a significant amount of work on gang homicides, shootings, stabbings, even spent a lot of time doing child abuse. Throughout my career, I've had the honor and the pleasure to work with the East Metro Gang Enforcement Team, and they are one of the few teams that really jumps out at me as a fantastic model for how best to work with this particular set of crime. In particular, they bring knowledge that is vital to this community and to the people that are most affected by gang crime. What is unique about gang crime in particular is that it changes. As much as we may think it has a kind of set pattern or set boundaries, the gang officers who are there on the street every day get to see the unique changes in how the crimes are committed, what drives the crimes, and they help also on a daily basis steer youth away from that. Working as a prosecutor and seeing many cases on a daily basis, particularly in this these past 2 weeks, the East Metro Gang Enforcement Team has brought to me some very violent and horrific crimes that they've worked diligently and very effectively to investigate and to make arrest in. On a daily basis, they are the individuals that are out on the street making contact with the citizens and making arrests that are very necessary. It is the partnership that we see with them is vital both to the Renew Project, to the District Attorney's Office, and I believe it is vital to that very community. So it is my honor today to be here to testify on their behalf and to support this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I can go ahead if you want.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tracy Freeman, and I'm a senior manager of Probation and Accountability Services for Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, Juvenile Services Division. So I'd like to thank you for the opportunity and being able to offer our support of Senate Bill 501 today. The goals of our Gang Transition Services funds are to reduce juvenile crime and to reduce the overrepresentation of minority youth in the justice system by keeping youth in their own families and communities. The passage of Senate Bill 501 would provide continued funding to support East Metro Gang Enforcement Team. The work accomplished through MGAT has been done in close partnership with a variety of agencies and organizations, including City of Gresham, Gresham Police Department, Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, Latino Network, and Portland Opportunities Industrialization Center. This working partnership has resulted in a number of opportunities to address these issues. For instance, Multnomah County and the City of Gresham have submitted a joint application for a federal promise zone designation. That could result in improvements to the community around education, jobs, creation, and crime reduction. And Multnomah County and City of Gresham received a National League of Cities grant to improve juvenile justice. The team is currently in Washington, D.C., as we mentioned earlier, for technical assistance. And a number of other partners were working together to begin implementing the Office of Juvenile Justice Delinquency Prevention for the comprehensive gang model to help develop solutions to the gang issue that affects areas such as East County. A number of other partners are also working to launch a police diversion program with Gresham Police Department that would deliver culturally specific wraparound services to youth and families, specifically in East County. Funding for the East Metro Gang Enforcement Team allows these partnerships to address issues such as crime, employment, law enforcement, and livability issues in Gresham and East Multnomah County. Multnomah County recognizes that gang members do not know or respect municipal boundaries, and that successful efforts in the East Metro Gang Enforcement Team help decrease gang activity in other parts of the region and the state by ensuring it's stopped there and not exported or expanded to communities. We ask for your support of Senate Bill 10501. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mariel Moda. I'm the Community Leadership Development Coordinator at the Rosewood Initiative. The Rosewood Initiative is a nonprofit organization started as a public safety initiative in collaboration with Portland and Gresham Police and the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. And it originally started with the intent of creating healthier relationships between community members and public safety agencies. The idea was to give the community a safe place to come and interact in a non-confrontational, non-adversarial way with police officers, sheriffs, and the like, probation officers. It's over time, in the last 4 years, evolved into a larger community space where we provide everything from housing assistance to job services to any kind of resources that we can offer our community, which is, as you've heard repeatedly, we're far east Portland on the border of Gresham, and this neighborhood is very diverse, very poor, lacking in services and lacking in education and other resources, and it's highly affected by crime. So the Rosewood Initiative tries to provide a space for the community to become healthier, and through that space we've also partnered with any agency that is willing to partner with us to benefit the community in any way that they can. So our main public safety focus is through connection and relationships, and we're here to support MGET because a big part of MGET is being an initiative which encourages interagency collaborations, and like was just said, crime doesn't really care about the borders between cities, and communication is everything. So we really are here to support the building of partnerships between safety officials and members of the community and anything which truly addresses the issue of the fluidity of crime in our neighborhood.
Great. Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Thank you all very much for taking the time to come today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Peluso.
While she comes up, I want to just put on the record, too, that the police officers are seeing, I tend to like to visit the neighborhood associations, and I think we have 16 of them in the Gresham area. And the police officer are there, and Chief Jenniger are there, talking about gangs, gang prevention, showing what they do, et cetera. So it is, police are becoming more and more involved in wraparound services. They just don't give out tickets and arrest people.
Eat donuts. Chell Gelser, members of the committee, it is my honor and privilege to be here before you today to testify on behalf of continued funding of the East Metro Gang Enforcement Team. I am still Representative Carla Peluso, serving House District 50, the city of Gresham, and a small chunk of southeast Portland. Prior to my legislative service, I was a proud 30-year member of the Gresham Police Department. My last six years, I served as the Gresham Police Chief. During my police career, I saw many changes and much growth in the city of Gresham and all of East Multnomah County. Let me share a bit of that history. In 1985, annexation nearly doubled the size of Gresham, literally overnight. Unintended consequences followed: gentrification, the need for sewer systems, the lack of social services to meet the growing community needs, and increased public safety needs.
In 1989, we designated one detective as a gang detective, and shortly thereafter, our first gang was identified. It was called Posse 91, consisting of white middle-class high school students. Because they did not fit the stereotype we have of gang members, we had great difficulty convincing anyone that Posse 91 did fit the gang profile, the profile of an active criminal gang, and needed to be treated accordingly, including arrest and prosecution. It was time to accept that gang activity existed in Gresham. In 1990, the Rockwood Safety Action Team was formed, a collaboration between the Gresham Police Department and the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. Gang and drug-related issues were addressed, and community's partners participated with a focus on prevention. Unfortunately, funding and politics closed that office in just 2 years. My point, and I do have one, many programs have come and gone since 1985. In the fall of 2004, a bus tour took place in East Multnomah County, focusing on the cities of Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. Our guests for the tour were elected members of each city and representatives from the legislature at that time. The blight list was clearly and quickly recognized by the tour, and with subsequent discussions and collaborations with state, county, and local governments, the East Metro Gang Enforcement Team was birthed and funded by the state of Oregon. MGET was officially launched in 2005. As you have heard, the team is a collaborative effort of many jurisdictions, community advocates, our schools, and nonprofits. Today, MGET has a 10-year history of gang enforcement, gang prevention, and gang intervention. The team has morphed and evolved into a highly respected unit that serves the Multnomah County community. The team's expertise is sought out by other agencies throughout our state, by our schools, by our federal partners, and by the district attorneys. The East Metro Gang Enforcement Team, and now here comes the big point, has longevity, a 10-year track record of success. I ask for your continued support of this highly regarded service. It is an investment in our community and public safety. More important, it is a long-term investment in our kids and our families. It is crime prevention by breaking the cycles of violence and the cycles of poverty. MGET involved under my watch as the Gresham Police Chief. I count it as one of my greatest achievements. I strongly ask, actually implore, for your continued support of this unit. It is tried and true. It is focused on the success of our community. It is crime prevention, and it is hope. Thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions for Representative Peluso? Senator Dimbro.
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, both the sponsors, for bringing this forward. I'm curious about the appropriation amount. $1,999,290. That seems like an odd number. So can you explain where that number comes from?
Right. I am sorry that I didn't get this on OLIS, but it funds one sergeant, two Gresham police officers, a Troutdale police officer, a Fairview police officer, and then overtime training and equipment is rolled into that. Plus, it funds a Multnomah County deputy, two Multnomah County deputies, and a Multnomah County central, and then the indirect rate. Anyway, that comes to a total of $1,999,000. Anyway, and I had this, and I forgot to send it to...
Madam Chair, I'll supplement the record.
Good if you get at it.
I'll post it
great.
After.
Thank
I'll
you.
Get it out.
And then we'll make sure that it's part of the public record.
Perfect. Great. Any other comments
Thank
or questions?
You.
No. I have a comment.
Senator Olson.
I do support this bill. You guys need all the help you can get. But this really opens up a door for the Curry County, Josephine County, all the other counties that don't have police enforcement that really need it, and come to the state and say, you know, hey, support us, and they're not getting the support. It's unfortunate that we senators, and I'm blaming us, we've let this happen. It's unfortunate that we're there, but I'll support this bill wholeheartedly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? Seeing none, thank you all very much. And Senator Mata Sanderson, thank you for putting together some great panels today to help us learn about Gresham and Rockwood and East County. So thank you all very much. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 501, and our work for today is complete. We are adjourned.
Right on time.
Is complete. We are adjourned.